You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at wearelibertarians.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Episode 45, The Paradox.
Welcome to The Paradox with your attending, Dr. Eric Larson. He is a practicing anesthesiologist and clinical assistant professor at Michigan State University College of Human Medicine. Listen in as he takes you behind the scenes of what practicing medicine in today's ever-changing world is like with another doctor. The Paradox is a fun and accidentally informative show for physicians, patients, or anyone who has ever found themselves in a waiting room.
Welcome to The Paradox. I'm your host, Dr. Eric Larson. Thank you for joining me as we explore the U.S. medical system in a fun and informative format where you can learn about what physicians face through expert analysis. Today's expert on episode 45 is Dr. Jack Cochran. Dr. Cochran is a former CEO of Kaiser Permanente Medical Group, which is the one that controls the physicians within the organization. Thousands of physicians stretching from coast to coast. He was CEO from 2007 through 2015 and has recently finished completing a book called Healer, Leader, Partner, where his primary argument is that he thinks physicians need to be more than just healers, but leaders in all aspects of our patients' care. This means we also have to control costs and be cognizant of it, as one of the leading causes of bankruptcy in this country is medical bankruptcy. And so we have to own that part in whatever way we can, whether that means we can be leaders just within our group, within our hospital system, or somewhere else. One of the things I enjoy so much about this show is what I learned from other people. I've learned about other specialties, how people solve problems, new problems that I didn't know existed. The interesting part is to find out how other people see problems, how they see to solve them. And it's entirely dependent oftentimes on their knowledge base and sort of what sort of systems they came from before. So in talking to Dr. Cochran and primarily listening, I heard what his perspective was of someone who is in the baby boomer generation and his thoughts about solving our problems today. Now, the primary thrust of the book, although it is emphasizing physician leadership, is about three quarters or two thirds focus on just leadership skills in general. So if you're someone who is in charge of a department, a hospital, whether it's healthcare or not healthcare, really, you're going to find a lot of value in this book. Actually, there was as a former president of my group for 4 years, it certainly would have been very helpful if I had some sort of tips, a ways to address problems and HR issues that happen. Because it turns out that most of the time when you're in leadership, a lot of it is just trying to convince people or to find consensus for a direction and vision of how you're going to move your organization forward or in solving disputes. And so this book actually has a lot of really good things in there. Whether you agree with the first thrust of the book about healthcare and sort of how a physician can solve it, it doesn't really matter because the bulk of the book is actually about leadership skills, which we got to a little bit during the interview, but we mostly kind of hovered around the healthcare issues. If you're a listener of the show for quite some time, you certainly know sort of my perspective and where I think things should go as far as in how we solve problems. And I didn't push back a lot with Dr. Cochran, although we probably disagree on a lot of the basic premises that he makes. But what I think was interesting is if you listen to our conversation, especially near the end, our goals are exactly the same. And I think most people, when they're looking at healthcare and how to solve it, I don't think there's much question of what we think we want healthcare to look like. We want the relationship between a patient and a physician. We all want the same thing. We want it to be affordable. We want it to be high quality. We want it to have a personal touch. And that's what he's looking for, and that's what I'm looking for. And I think it comes out really well when you listen to the discussion at the end when I start talking about how I found a solution with direct primary care, which we've talked about a number of times in the show, and I've switched to a direct primary care physician too over the last few months. And his immediate reaction is not one of, well, that's a terrible idea, that would never work. It's really interesting because he gets really excited. And I think this is what we need to remember when we're talking to people who may have very divergent views from us as far as solutions. And we need to be mindful of how we respond to people who have solutions that we have not considered or we think may not be useful. This is what conversation is supposed to be. You're supposed to do mostly listening and learning. And if you have some insight or something that you think would provide new knowledge for the person who's talking, who is, if they're curious at all, which Dr. Cochran obviously is, you're going to find they're going to be very receptive to things if it achieves the goals they want. And so just our discussion with direct primary care and a pilot program, and he's entirely right in that he's very excited about this possibility. He'd never heard of it before. And you think, well, this is someone who's in healthcare, in policy, and talking about all the time, but you also have to recognize where he's coming from. And I think that connection we make is really interesting at the end. I think it's one that I think I hope everyone understands, that when you're talking with people about things, it's easy to tell people what you think when it's probably more important to listen to what they think. And you're probably going to learn more and you're going to be more, better able to make arguments or certainly at least provide new information that they will find and interesting and maybe more receptive to. So anyway, other housekeeping, all the show notes page will be at theparadox.com/045, which is the most significant because that's actually the 1 year anniversary of this show. And it's been fantastic and far more successful than I thought ever possible. So I thank each and every one of you who listens and subscribes, shares with your friends. I will continue to put out as great a product as I can. I feel like I'm getting better at this. I'm certainly getting faster editing. And I will continue to try and find topics. And I encourage you to go to the webpage at theparadox.com, sign up for the email list, send me messages if you think there are people I need to talk to or topics that have not been broached. I use a lot of those topics actually in suggestions besides ones that I just come up with on my own. But this is what keeps the show, I think, fresh and I think real interesting, and I hope, hopeful. I'm far more hopeful now than I was when I started the show. And so for that, I thank you too, despite everything that's gone on in the last year. But without further ado, I'd like to get to the show since it's a longer interview. Dr. Jack Cochran, author of Healer, Leader, Partner. Enjoy. Well, hey folks, I'm here with my new friend, Dr. Jack Cochran, who is served as the executive director and CEO of the Permanente Federation, the national organization of Permanente medical groups from 2007 to 15, where he led innovations in healthcare delivery and major improvements in clinical quality. He's also served as the president, executive medical director, and chairman of the board of the Colorado Permanente Medical Group from 1999 to 2007, and established its Department of Plastic Surgery. Modern Healthcare named Dr. Cochran one of the 50 most influential physician executives in healthcare in 2009, 10, and 2012. Under his leadership, Kaiser Permanente implemented electronic health record, the largest successful non-government clinical information systems deployment in the world. He earned his medical degree from the University of Colorado School of Medicine and served residencies at Stanford University Medical Center and the University of Wisconsin Hospital. He's board certified in otolaryngology. You're the second one I've had just recently. And in plastic and reconstructive surgery. He practiced plastic and reconstructive surgery at St. Joe's Hospital in Denver from 81 to 2007, where he also served as chief of surgery, president of the medical staff, and was a member of the hospital board of directors for 2 terms. Dr. Cochran just recently finished a book called Healer, Leader, and Partner, and that's what we're going to be discussing today, along with his long career, I guess, as a physician leader. Dr. Cochran, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you, Eric. It's great to be here.
Well, I think we'll start with just a little bit of your background. Why don't you tell us the story of, I guess, your training, how you got to Denver, maybe, and then sort of how you fell into the position, because it sounds like it was not a trajectory you had planned on for your career, but sort of how you fell into your role within Permanente.
Right. Your choice of the word falling into it may be prescient. I've made a few career moves, most of which were sort of spontaneous at the time of changing context or realities in healthcare and my own reaction to it. So I started out, I wanted to do pediatric surgery And as I looked at all the fields in pediatric surgery, I decided I liked reconstructive surgery the best. I trained in plastic and reconstructive surgery. Went to at University of Wisconsin, went to Denver, which was home for me, to practice. I joined two wonderful surgeons who did not only pediatrics, but general plastic and cosmetic surgery, and was very happy there, enjoyed the group, enjoyed the practice. But it was at a time when the insurance industry became enamored with something that they called managed care. And it wasn't managing care. It was the insurance version of manipulating doctors and patients' decision-making to try to control healthcare costs. And
right.
I became very concerned that I would have to write these pleading letters to insurance companies about doing reconstructive procedures on children with facial deformities, because the company would say it was cosmetic, and I would send these passionate letters saying, what is missing in your logic is that for a child from age 4 to age 12, the most important organ in their body is their face, because that's how they interact with the world. It impacts their self-confidence, their self-esteem, their development. And I didn't get a lot of insightful thank you notes back. I got a continuous sure. dialogue about, well, it's still cosmetic. Thank you for your nice thoughts, Dr., but it's still cosmetic. So I became alerted to the fact that maybe healthcare was changing. This was in the 90s. And I worked in St. Joseph Hospital in Denver alongside a bunch of doctors from Kaiser Permanente. And they were, as I observed them, they were good doctors. They seemed to have a high quality. And it was a growing system. It was a system that I hadn't worked in, but I did some consults for them. And so I thought they were pretty good. And as the coincidence happens, after about 9 years in private practice, Kaiser decided they wanted to internalize some of their subspecialties like neurosurgery and plastic surgery. So they recruited me. And I said no for about a year and a half because I really liked my team and my partners. But then as these insurance companies got more passionate about trying to control costs, I decided I would join Kaiser Permanente. So I was their first plastic surgeon, started their program. And then after a few years there, this is a repeat of my pattern, sort of a slalom course career, Kaiser started being challenged by some of the market forces. And my colleagues, and I've been there about 8 years this time as a full-time surgeon, encouraged me to run for the board of directors of the medical group. And while I was there, I was told by people that I was a balanced thinker and a good listener. And I didn't really know that I was either of those, but I was encouraged. I was actually the board chair, and then I was selected to be the president of the group, which I served with great pride for 8 years. So I got involved on the job. As I said, my surgical training was 4 years of medical school, 6 years of residency, and extensive mentoring, monitoring, and certification. But my business and leadership career was on the job, just in time, trial and error, a very different path, but that's what I did. And so I was the physician lead for the Colorado region. At the time, about 600,000 members, 800 doctors, that sort of thing. And we did really well. I had great people that I worked with. We made some great improvements. We installed an electronic health record twice, our original one, and then the Epic systems. We became leaders in quality. So I was then recruited to be the national leader for the Permanente Federation. And I served there from 08 to 07 to 15. So as you see, I made multiple rather significant changes, direction, course corrections or whatever in my career about every 8 to 10 years, and ended up with being the physician lead for Kaiser Permanente nationally.
Yeah, it's funny how sometimes life just takes you're almost like on a stream, like a lazy river, and your path is determined before you really even recognize what's going on.
Yeah, there may have been some destiny to what I did, but it certainly seemed like I was mostly reacting to what I thought were either opportunities or problems where there was a sense that I could be useful. So it was an interesting journey, and I wouldn't change any of it.
Absolutely. And you know, it's when you're talking there about how your training in medicine is fairly, I don't want to say standard, but there's definitely a structure to how we get trained as through medical school and then a residency training for our specialties. And then the other positions that we hold in medicine is, like you said, just sort of, you just by the seat of your pants, you're just kind of discovering, you know, how to do things like be a leader,
right.
It reminds me very much of parenting, right? I mean, you just suddenly are a parent and you have to kind of figure it all out. As anyone who's a parent knows, they don't really, you sort of vaguely know what's supposed to be done, but to actually do the day-to-day operations and to figure out how to do it well is a trial by error.
It's a fantastic analogy. And I always said that working with operating room leaders like surgeons and anesthesiologists is like raising teenagers, not just children,
yes.
but teenagers, because
yes.
there's a level of independence and sort of, you know, self-determination that doesn't always immediately lead itself to team play and group thinking and following and that sort of thing.
Well, I was president of my anesthesia group, which is about 100 physicians. We have 70 senior nurse anesthetists and anesthesiologist assistants. And that was a role that it wasn't one that I had ever envisioned taking on. I've now not been present for a couple of years now. And there are a number of things in your book that would have been helpful to have had some insight in how to deal with certain crowds and groups. So I appreciate a lot of that's in the book. One of the reasons I think you wrote the book was that you're urging physicians to take a lead in healthcare, in medicine, hospitals, and to try and direct the where we're going. What sort of argument do you make for physicians? Why do you think they need to be leaders?
Right, and the book was a fairly significant self-reflection of mega trends in healthcare over my three decades, some of which went very well and some of which didn't go very well. And I was struck, and I continue to be struck by my friends and colleagues in medicine who are now mid to late career and are very unhappy. And unfortunately, it's not a tiny number, it's a significant number. And so what all has changed during that time? And I found that leadership was a platform where physicians actually could have a voice. And that is in contrast to two other roles. So physician as leader in contrast to physician as victim, which feels a great futility, and the fact that change is going on all around us and that we are sort of being led or told what to do, and it's not a very positive feeling. But the other extreme is physician as tyrant, which just says, I'm in charge, do things my way, and then I'll be happy. And neither of those extremes work. And so physician as leader it's not just a position or a title. It's an understanding of a commitment that comes out of the role of healer. And the role of healer is the role we all sign up for. It's the covenant between us and patients to be aware of their physical, emotional needs, of their fear and their uncertainty. And so the role of healer is what we sign up for. And I often contrast myself and my colleagues when we were 21 versus when we were 51 or 41 or 61. When we were 21, we wanted to be or dreamed of being physicians, and we had to write a couple of paragraphs in our applications to medical school. And if we reread ours or others at that time, we would find that they are remarkably similar. And those two paragraphs are just full of hope and optimism and compassion. We were the prototypical 21-year-old idealist who was going to make a difference and change the lives for people. And what happens fast forward 20, 30 years to that 21-year-old idealist? That has really struck me. So in addition to the role of healer, which we signed up for, our patients also encounter the system physically, socially, psychologically, financially. All these other things happen. And we didn't necessarily believe we signed up for that. So we sometimes opt out and say, well, my job is clinical quality. Affordability is somebody else's job, or mm-hmm. access is somebody else's job. And when we opt out, the problem doesn't go away, but somebody else works to solve it. And our voice is lost. And again, not physician as victim and not physician as tyrant, but physician as leader has to opt in and say, I'm going to have to understand a little bit about the issues of affordability, because high clinical quality, which is what I believe I'm delivering, when the patient lacks affordable access to me, is irrelevant. And so that's it. The healthcare delivery is still, in most systems, over 80 cents of every healthcare dollar that's spent. And physicians have disproportionate impact. And so if we have disproportionate impact, should we not accept disproportionate responsibility? And a lot of that money gets spent based on the conversation, the trusted conversation between doctors and patients. And so how do we believe that we can play a different role there? So that's why I think physician as healer needs to also understand that leadership, and again, it doesn't have to have a title or a position. It's a point of view that says, this is my profession. These are people who trust me, and I'm going to step forward and be part of the solution.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting. Could you talk about the physicians control 80% of the costs, or, and it, with their conversation with their patients. I know a number of physicians would disagree with that, in that they would say, and rightly or wrongly, that they really don't even know how much anything costs. So our system is very complicated. So for them to change implants, say they use a different, you know, knee implant system, or whether they schedule an MRI at the hospital or an outpatient center, physicians rarely have those. Sometimes they don't have those decisions to make. They don't have that ability to make a decision. But how do you think they have a better way of controlling these costs? Because in many ways, although they have the decision for a test to occur, they don't really have a option for where it occurs or for what the patient ultimately does. Do you understand my question?
Yes. And I think it's a perfect question and a perfect framework to shine light on decisions that we make as individuals. If we choose the role of victim, we say, well, we don't have the information. We don't know what to do. We're stuck. That's just the way it is. Mm-hmm. A physician as tyrant wants to beat their fist on the desk and say, I want it this way. But physician as leader says, maybe I need to learn about that. Maybe I need to have more of an opinion. Maybe I need to be less passive about those things. Mm-hmm. And so there are many factors and actions that affect costs. And much of it still funnels through the doctor-patient conversation. And so if you are a doctor who puts in knee implants, you should have a point of view about that and understand, first and foremost, of course, what do you think is the best quality for the patients that you have? What is the best quality of the knee implant? But then you also have to understand that hospitals may have 25 orthopedic surgeons, and if they have to custom order every patient's knee implant or order from 8 or 10 different knee implants, it's a very different cost reality than mm-hmm. if 25 orthopedic surgeons could get together and say, because we understand that it is about quality, but affordable access is an essential pathway to get patients so they can have coverage and have surgery and have care, we have to understand that maybe we have to participate and maybe take a look at 25 orthopedists and say, how deep are our biases? Because if you really need something, we'll give it to you. But actually, it turns out that the 25 of you could take care of 98% of your knee patients with 3 or 4 different implants. It right. changes the ability to purchase and keep those kind of things. So again, the doctor-patient relationship is important, but it has been proven, and this is the this is what physicians can't remove from their thinking and the conversation. During our careers and today, we have seen incredible progress in healthcare, incredible positive developments. We've seen improvements. We've seen breakthroughs. We've seen miracles, and we've seen cures. We've seen things. We've seen things like HIV go from a fatal diagnosis to a chronically treatable condition. We've seen cancer go from being often a fatal diagnosis to being curable. We've seen heart disease through the use of all kinds of interventions and pharmacotherapies become much more manageable and much less ominous. And all those things have happened. But during that time, there are two realities today that are not hypothetical and not unproven. They are proven that in spite of all those good things that have happened, there are two statistics that continue to not change. Medical error is the number three cause of death in this country. After cancer and heart disease, number three is medical error. Then come accidents and other diseases. So the number three cause of death. And medical bills are the number two cause of family and personal bankruptcy after job loss. Those are not wacky data from the fringe. Those are data that are proven year after year. And in healthcare, patients, we know that there are patients who are unreasonable in their demands and that want this. And we know there are patients who are hypochondriacal, et cetera. But most patients, let's not forget that even though we may be having a tough day or being a little frustrated in our careers, the role of patient is involuntary. People don't wake up in the morning and saying, gosh, you know, it's been a while since I was a patient. I want to take another shot at that one. Yesterday I was healthy. Today I had a heart attack. Yesterday I was healthy. Today somebody told me I had cancer. Yesterday I was healthy and today I was hit by a car. Healthcare, or the role of patient, is not only involuntary, but it's often instantaneous. And so we can't forget that. And once they're in the system, they encounter the finances, they encounter those things. And so the thing about the medical impact is that we still have documented proof that some of the cost of healthcare is from overuse, underuse, and misuse of therapies and care. And for our patients, sometimes, and this is the doctor-patient covenant, for our patients, sometimes unreasonable demand is their proxy for poor access, poor communication, or low trust. Because if a doctor honestly believes a patient doesn't need something done, and the patient and the doctor have a trusting relationship, that's often a high confidence decision. That doesn't mean that you can't monitor and change your mind and learn, but patients don't often have unreasonable demand if there's a high level of trust in that relationship. And sure. And families are stuck with this reality about healthcare costs, and what have they done? Because they used to have no family share of their health insurance premiums. It was paid by their employers or the government. And then, as costs went up and up and up, employers started to say, we've got to do something about these premiums. We want our employees to have a little, they call it skin in the game. So we want you to have a share of the premiums. So families originally had $100 a month for their share of the premium, then $200, then $300, all of a sudden $500 or $600. Now the families are starting to say, wait a minute, now we need some relief from this premium. And then they make another decision, which is to try to control or lower the premium by opting for a cost sharing or a higher deductible. And that then puts some of the cost of healthcare at risk for the family, and it lowers the premium, or it keeps the premium under somewhat control. The problem with that logic is it's true, but it's also a little bit of a bet. It's a little bit of a wager that says we're not going to ever need to spend that $5,000 deductible or that $7,000 deductible. But inevitably, what happens in the average family, and this is why healthcare affects the average family, these are not poor homeless people. These are people we know and are in mm-hmm. our lives. Yeah. They have these kind of conversations inside the family. Well, Johnny needs to have his tonsils out, but our refrigerator just went out. This month, we have to spend $1,000 on the refrigerator. Johnny's going to have to put the tonsillectomy off a bit. Or Lucy needs an MRI of her knee after a soccer injury, but the clutch went out in my truck. This month, I've got to get the clutch replaced in my truck because that's how I go to work. And so families are rationing healthcare at the kitchen table. They are rationing healthcare based on their realities. Or they do something even worse. They put everything on a credit card, and then that just compiles. So the American dream is being significantly impacted by healthcare costs. And you see it everywhere. You see it with governments, with companies, with politicians. But it's the reality that we ought to care about is that family that has to ration healthcare at the kitchen table because they're balancing the realities of their life because of these new and healthcare reform with more coverage of people with less means and more of these elections for deductible plans has just shined a brighter light on it. It wasn't that the health reform was the problem. It's just that people got in and they said, oh, well, I've got coverage now. That's great. But oh my gosh, there is a cost sharing. And right. and the cost sharing that we talked about earlier about the insurance companies trying to say, well, cost sharing will be an important way to try to modulate unreasonable demand. Well, the facts are in, and they are becoming clearer that when you put cost sharing in place, you do reduce some patients' utilization of maybe marginally indicated medications or interventions. But unhappily, you also decrease patients' utilization of fully indicated therapies and interventions. And so it's not a pure good outcome. So cost-sharing patients take less of their prescriptions, cut doses in half, defer or delay necessary care. Very, very, very stark reality. And so then as physicians, do we opt in and say when it comes to a joint replacement implant, I'm not helpless. I want to be involved and I want to hear and I want to listen. And so let's be involved. And that's physician as partner, the third role I talk about, which is I don't want to out-finance my finance officer at the hospital. I want to sit down with the committee that does decisions around acquisitions of materials and drugs. And I just want to have a chance to listen and a chance to participate. Again, physician as victim doesn't even participate. Physician as tyrant says, do it my way. And right. unfortunately, nobody has enough influence and power to just direct things.
So that it leads to a kind of interesting discussion because when you look at hospitals now, I would say there are very few hospitals that don't have any sort of system involved, like a healthcare system or employed medical group or things like that. There are hybrid hospitals in which they have both independent physicians who refer or work within the hospital, along with some sort of employee group. And then there are hospitals that are, I imagine, are entirely employed, sort of all part of the system. Like those used to be primarily university systems at one point, but now mm-hmm. they're more, right. In those systems that are hybrids, that's the sort of system I work in. What do you think the role is for affiliated, non-affiliated physicians, and how do they work together to achieve goals? Because it's obviously, if you're in a system where it's all controlled from one point, it's pretty easy from a hierarchical standpoint to figure out, you know, who makes decisions and sort of how they go out. And you can kind of figure out where in the system you can go to make change. But what about the relationship where you have the hybrid, where you have both independent and employed physicians? How do they make decisions together and get along?
Well, that's...
Because that's how you were initially in your career, right?
Exactly. And that's the experiment we're running all over the country, actually all over the world right now. Mm-hmm. And there is no single solution to that very complex calculus. But where it does work, there is no question there is true leadership. And the leadership is not just randomly representing its constituency and its subgroup, but it's leadership that embraces that we are part of a system and we have a sense of direction. Some call it vision, some call it, you know, the direction, which is why we do it, which may be more mission. Those are soft words. They appear in brochures and they get framed on the walls of hospitals, but they don't necessarily get lived and actually believed. So you have to have some, if you're going to create a system like that, it has to be rallied around some level of governance. And what is the governance? Well, governance says the enterprise is important enough that it has to have some sense of how does it represent various voices. And so it's not just a small executive team handing out memos. That is done, and I can talk about that under leadership. That's done some places, and it's done by fiat, and it's a very low trust model for how you get things done. You just tell people what to do, and they do it or else. Yeah. And that's expedient. You can do that relatively quickly. It does not build a vibrant organization that continues to learn as change continues to get more dynamic and worse and continues to innovate. The notion of just command and control as your only level of leadership is very efficient, but it has tremendous limitations in the long run because of the kind of culture you create. And you create a culture that's continuously, in this sort of situation, continuously fractious. Because if you don't necessarily have a sense that the employed physicians and the independents have a common sense of view of the future, then they are frequently and regularly going to be either in conflict with the administration or with each other. And so there is not one model that works, but there are models that work. And they start off with a lot of convening and listening to the key people. And this sounds soft and it sounds slow and it's both of those, but it is the way that a really, truly longitudinally healthy culture gets developed. And you create culture by having very clear values and expectations. And those values and expectations are expressed to a new person before they even join the medical staff or join the group or join the employed group. These are our values and expectations. And people go, well, that's not what I want. I want to be a tyrant. I want to be in it. Well, then I suggest you not sign up for this. But those values and expectations, you have to have them clear. Yeah, that's why the governance body, whether it's the board or the medical executive committee or whatever, has to agree on what do we stand for. Once you have those values and expectations, you recruit with them, and people are hired, you orient with the same ones. When you evaluate them, you give the same criteria. When you do training and development, you do the same criteria, values and expectations. When you evaluate and promote people, if you really are clear about that, people wean out. People say, I don't like that. I want to be more autonomous. I want to have more control. I want to be less of a team player. Okay, there are places where you can do that. But if you're trying to build a culture of a more integrated system, you have to have that. Those values and expectations have to come from some sort of governance body. They say it could be medical staff exec committee, it can be the board, it can be a combination. But those people don't come to those by closing the doors, making up their own minds, and having a fiat. There has to be some system where they spend some time understanding and listening to people. And it also happens over time. You don't make change quickly, you make change over time. And most people get impatient and try and just say, okay, screw it. These doctors are not going to go along. These doctors are the problem. These doctors are going to be obstructionists. Therefore, we're just going to become more and more controlling and more coercive. And that's one way to define a culture. It's not a place I want to work.
So to kind of change gears a little bit and going back to your book, sort of in the book, you talk about healthcare inflation and you mentioned that's a silent killer. So I think, you know, that's a reflection to the fact that the inflation for healthcare services is significantly higher than what I guess we'd say the normal CPI is, right? The inflation for normal products in our economy. Mm-hmm. So what do you think? What do you think leads to this accelerated inflation within healthcare? Because I have my thoughts, but I'm curious what you think.
Well, I talked about that a little bit. There are multiple factors and multiple actors that are contributing to that. But the reality is, when I started out as a practicing surgeon, healthcare was 10% of GDP. Mm-hmm. It's now 18% of GDP. During those three decades, I've also added a grandson to my life, right? Mm-hmm. So he's now got the tab for the 18%. And I was not an unethical, bad doctor, but I got very prosperous during that run from 10 to 18%, as did many hospitals, many doctors, many pharmaceutical companies. And healthcare inflation is relatively silent, but at a company level, their bottom line, which is, you know, the difference between expenses and revenues, are significantly affected by the cost of their employees and the efficiency of their employees. So the cost of their employees, healthcare inflation continually competes with wage increases. And so companies that keep their health inflation under control can give people more raises, and companies that don't can't. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of interest by now corporate America on what healthcare costs are. And, you know, on the one hand, the far right view says, well, it's just the market will fix this. Let's just have an open market. Markets always lower costs. Well, they don't. They don't. And so the far right says, and we don't like regulation. Okay. Then watch the pharmaceutical and device industry track record and just say, how far is that one going to go? Because, you know, pharmaceuticals and devices, which, by the way, they're miraculous, they're wonderful, and they're important. But the fact is, we can't just have an unfettered open process where people can have whatever they want. And that's where some of these relationships and some of these conversations have to come to bear. We have no transparency of pricing in most places. And so there are places where a joint replacement may cost $15,000, and another place for a joint replacement may cost $100,000. And we don't always necessarily know why. But I will say this. It is changing in terms of our awareness and our knowledge and our understanding of what causes certain things to happen. And a lot of it is happening in the world of the information age of healthcare, where we now have, I remember even at Kaiser Permanente, our idea of risk stratifying people to see who we should spend more attention on was age and gender. You know, if you're a male or a female and you're over 60 or over 80 or whatever, we have certain things that say that I need to be more attentive to your health. Well, in the world of extensive data and the ability to create algorithms and analytics to study that data and the application of things like artificial intelligence, all of a sudden we have this system where we can be much more precise. Now, one of the things we thought was going to make things very precise was the genome, the human genome. And we're early, maybe a little disappointed. Well, actually, human genome is very important, and it's an important part of the analytics. But we, for example, go back to the joint replacement. Mm-hmm. You can say if a joint replacement costs $15,000 or $20,000 versus $100,000, those events are analyzable, and there are reasons that happened. And so once you know the reasons, you have a fighting chance of understanding what lever to pull. And if the reason is the length of stay is 8 days versus 2 days, or the surgeon takes 6 hours versus 2 hours, those are data points that have some ability to influence. Or if you say this joint prosthesis was $12,000 and this one was $2,000. Once you start having true data with conclusions that can be seen and acted on, you start to see different levers being pulled and not the levers of just cutting. But if one surgeon's length of stay for a procedure is much longer than the others, then you can say, and he or she would say, well, my patients are sicker.
Yeah, right.
Well, guess what? We now have analytics on your patients, and they're a lot sicker. So therefore, we need to resource you with a little more time, a little more operating distance, or guess what? Your patients aren't sicker at all. You're just slow, or you're just like to keep them in the hospital. And we resist this because we like the autonomy of the profession. But again, we have to keep framing those two questions, which is healthcare affordably accessible to get to this high quality? And we can't duck the fact that we are in that equation. And secondly, what kind of ancestors are we going to be if my grandson can't afford my health care and my Social Security and all the things that I want as a baby boomer when he goes to work? We can't just keep kicking the thing down the road. Warren Buffett, who is arguably one of the best capitalists in the world, one of the richest men in the world, but also one of the most human rights sensitive people, he really bridges both political extremes very effectively. He says, we didn't need the corporate tax cuts of 2017-18. We didn't need those. What we need is to control healthcare costs, because healthcare inflation is the tapeworm in the American economy, just continually draining the American economy. I use the analogy, it's like uncontrolled hypertension. Uncontrolled hypertension doesn't have much symptomatology until you have a stroke or a heart attack. So we can talk around cause and effect for healthcare inflation. We got to stop talking around its reality. And so therefore, why not figure out what the real levers are, what the real data is? And we found some glaring things, like, you know, if somebody can do a joint replacement in 2 hours and somebody else takes 5 or 6 hours, does physician autonomy trump all the issues that patients encounter? Because that's what we've done. We've said, Cochrane's a good guy. We like him. We don't care how slow he is. He gets pretty good results. Well, guess what? We've measured Cochrane's results. Yeah. They're not as good as the woman that he practices with. And she takes 2 hours to do a joint replacement, and Cochrane takes 4 or 5. And she gets as good or better results. So does physician autonomy trump patients' needs? Wicked question. And if somebody can do 15 cataracts in a day versus someone who can do 3 or 4, you know, admittedly, the one who does 3 or 4 in a fee-for-service model doesn't get the same income, but those operating rooms still cost $2,000 an hour. Sure. And so one, even though the surgeon may not be rewarded with as many pieces of income, those operating rooms are so inefficient. And so, again, do we let physician autonomy trump some of the realities? Those are hard, hard conversations, but if we don't have them, and this is where I talk about the 30 years from the 21-year-old idealist. If we as doctors don't choose to participate in those conversations, somebody else does, and somebody else will. And so do you want to say, I'm going to stay unhappy and I'm going to stay on the sidelines because, by God, I'm doing the important work and the rest of you are the enemy? Well, guess what? They have jobs, and part of the finance people and part of the IT people is to do their job. And if we don't say we're going to partner with you, we're just going to object to you, then patients you've opted out and patients have lost a voice. Very important.
I was just going to say,
I talked about computers and data and all that. The reason that all that has evolved is not because we have some sinister IT industry. It's because of complexity. When I started out in training in plastic surgery, there was 3 journals, the American White Journal, the British Journal, and the Scandinavian Journal. Now there's probably 100 journals of various countries, various subspecialties of the specialty, and there's many more randomized controlled trials, and there's many more implantables and many more devices and many more antibiotics and many more of everything. My old computer, which was the human brain, is not up to the task of keeping track of all those things and keeping track of the data. So the first wave of complexity, while it gave us improvements, breakthroughs, miracles, and even cures, brought us uncontrollable complexity for our ability as humans and human brains to manage. So we had to have some sense of the input of computerized data, IT, et cetera. Plus, our patients became IT literate, and they expect, you know, when they expect to get cash, they don't expect to go to a bank and cash a check. That was 25 years ago. They don't even expect to necessarily go to a ATM and get cash. They want cash on their phone. Healthcare still is cashing some checks. And so patients are going, why can I make travel arrangements from an app on my way to the airport when I can't even get my medical record except by faxing it from one doctor to another? So we are at a threshold of opportunity, but if we don't, as physician leaders, participate as leaders and partners, as opposed to the old autonomy, we're going to get left behind. The first wave of a complexity, this increasingly explosive knowledge, drove more specialty care. So the cardiologist was no longer the woman or man for all seasons for the heart. There was cardiologists for the heart valves. There was cardiologists studying vessels. There was cardiologists studying the muscle, the myocardiopathy docs. There was cardiologists for the Purkinje fibers. You know, we got electrophysiology.
Right.
So
yeah.
the first wave of complexity created more focus on subspecialty care. But the second wave of complexity is very different. The second wave of complexity comes from the successes of the first wave, which is now patients with AIDS are being cured and treated with chronic conditions. Patients with heart disease are now being cured or treated as chronic conditions. People with asthma, people with cancer are now living and being treated as chronic conditions or cured. Well, guess what? We're also living longer. And yeah. I'm part of the boomers. The baby boomers are a huge cohort, and we think death is negotiable. You know, we want to keep living. We want to keep having parts improved and replaced, and we want to go on forever. Well, guess what? The second wave of complexity is people that are not only have these individual conditions, but they have two or three or four of them. That wave of complexity does not lend itself to just more subspecialists lining up, because a cardiologist, unless he or she is really in close communication with a nephrologist or a pulmonologist or a rheumatologist, is not getting the nuances of interaction and coordination of complex conditions. So the second wave of complexity has increased the importance of primary care with the healthcare team coordinating and processing all this information. They don't have to know as much as the electrophysiologist, but the primary care physician and team is now much more critical in the second wave. People are still going to go to subspecialists, but they have to have some group that can be a trusted focus and locus for coordination and trusted ongoing care in an integrated fashion. That's the second wave of complexity that people have not fully acknowledged, frankly.
Interesting. And so for me personally, So one of the things we've talked about in the show quite a bit is the lack of awareness of scarcity of resources and time, and as you mentioned, like, you know, OR time, and by both the physicians and the patients, and, you know, frankly, even the intermediaries as far as the pharmaceutical benefits and the implant people. And that cost is really never it's a secondary or tertiary sort of concern most of the time with most of the players who are making financial decisions ultimately. And it feels like a lot of times that the system that we have, where we have a payment system that is not direct between the patients or the employers, whoever's paying the bill, and the providers, distorts things significantly. It makes it hard for people to make decisions that make sense sometimes and to recognize the true costs of their decisions. I've switched my primary care. I no longer participate with an insurance company. I actually have a direct primary care where I just pay a membership fee, and it has been an eye-opening eye-opening sort of process. Not only do I have an HSA, so I now shop around for pharmaceuticals and can suddenly see the tremendous difference in the same cost of a drug from one pharmacy to the next, from, you know, in town. But also, I'm now I have a conversation with my primary care about the cost of everything. And it is very interesting because, you know, you can sort of more efficiently find things and get the same sort of quality product that you were before. But now you're involved as a patient in acquiring those tests and things. And those are conversations that I never had in sort of the traditional, you know, I guess you'd call it third-party system or whatever. You just have, you know, your usual HMO insurance or fee-for-service insurance. I mean, I feel like that is also... There are a lot of physicians taking charge and taking leadership roles by entering into those sorts of arrangements as a way of helping their patients navigate their healthcare as well.
Right. Right. That's true. And you are able to do that because you have the means to do that, right?
Well, I guess, although the person I see, most of her population actually are immigrants, and they only, because it only costs $50 a month to get this service from her,
okay.
You know, and so it's very affordable. You know, $600 a year for a 24/7 available primary care. I mean, that's because it's so expensive now. I mean, that wouldn't have been feasible, say, 25 years ago, because you basically going for free to your primary care. But that's changed, right? I mean, now with deductibles and with copays and things, you really can't get that sort of access to a physician, especially who knows you and can spend an hour with you if you need. So it's not really concierge in the sense, but I think those are the sorts of innovations that you're talking about, right? That are existing with healthcare. And those are ways that people as physicians are looking for solutions. I've talked to, you know, surgeons at the Surgery Center of Oklahoma where they now just have all cash price for everything. And then patients, even if they don't use their services, they can go and take those prices to their local hospital, and they're like, yeah, we'll match those. But it's definitely a tumultuous times within the healthcare, and it'll be interesting. And I think your point is the most important one, that as physicians, we have to own everything in the sense that we have to take responsibility for the whole process, whatever that may be, whatever decisions that may require of us.
And that model, it is a pilot. It's an experiment, right?
Sure.
And it sounds like it's working, and it's also working for poor people. So hallelujah to her.
Yeah.
Hallelujah to you. That is physician as leader and physician as partner, not just physician as healer. And hallelujah. Now, one of the troubling things in this country, which is not true in most countries, is who deserves access to healthcare. Is healthcare a right or a privilege? And without broaching that socio-political ethical question, here's what people who believe healthcare is a privilege miss, is that those people, so if you think it's a privilege, then you implicitly decide some people can't have or don't deserve healthcare for whatever reason, money or whatever. But guess what? We live in a system that's almost like a commons. Those people, even if they can't get Medicaid or Blue Cross or something, doesn't make them healthy. They don't get instantly healthy because they don't have coverage. And so the misguidedness of leaving people out is that somehow that saves money. Those people, between their basic getting sick too late, not getting necessary care, and being completely unproductive, they're still in our system. They're still in our communities. They're still in our hospitals. They're still in our cost. And so leaving people out as a way of thinking you save money is just a cost shift. People still get sick. You know, people that don't have insurance go into emergency rooms. I had to go to an emergency room once. I got a $12,000 bill for being there for half an hour. And I said, look at all this stuff. But my share was $50. But that's what they would bill somebody with no coverage. And they would collect zero. And so leaving people out of any sort of coverage does not solve the problem of the cost of healthcare. And that's where there is a place for the liberals and the conservatives to come together around coverage. But both are going to have to get things they don't want. The conservatives, if we're going to do a coverage, it'll have to be tiered. We're going to have some basic plan for everyone. And then we can opt up like you do. You opt up for cash, you opt up for this, that, or you get an insurance policy or something. But there would have to be some sense of regulation. You can't just have all these things go crazy. The market won't solve it. And that's what the liberals don't want. They don't want anything that has any inequity. Well, the most inequitable thing you have is no access and no coverage. So let's do it like public schools. Let's have a basic system, and then other people can opt up for the private education or whatever. And if you look at the totality of cost, and the problem is the buckets of cost are paid for by different people. That's why the government can't figure it out. They think, well, Medicare for all will be bad. Well, it could be bad. If it's done wrong. done wrong, it can be bad. And regulation is bad. Well, regulation is bad, but do we really want to have pharmaceuticals have no regulation and you know, devices? And so the hard questions are again, due to that second wave of complexity. And complexity, so our president is used to solving complicated problems, building the highest building in Dubai. That's a complicated problem. You got to get financing, architectural plans, land, permission, et cetera. But a complicated problem can be solved by one person being in charge and telling people what to do. And so that was how he built buildings. But complex problems do not have a linear hierarchy of decision-making because there are so many stakeholders that have so many points of view. Complex problems like healthcare or, frankly, foreign policy is about relationships and managing and building better effective relationships over time. And that's why the Congress can't reform healthcare. You're going to see these vitriolic debates on both sides, and they're missing the fact that if we both just gave up certain things. I had a guy who was a hardcore Republican who said to me, don't quote me on this, but I think we need a single-payer system to save the American economy. I said, well, honestly, I don't think we necessarily need a single-payer system, but I think we need universal coverage with some sort of a matrix of private and government, like we're developing in most states, frankly. But even Massachusetts, they've had health reform for 17 years. Their costs are still, their healthcare costs are still gobbling up all the other public costs. I mean, they're still spending more every year on healthcare than education. And there's still this ongoing cost shift into healthcare. And so this is one of the things I say to my doctor friends who quit. They said, I know how to solve my problem. I'm done. I'm vested. I'm done. I said, well, unfortunately, you leave behind for your children and grandchildren a system that you don't want them to be doctors. Well, I don't want them to be patients. We quitting is maybe an adaptive behavior for us as individuals, but we still have a high reputation. Physicians are still the most trusted healthcare profession is nursing, but the most trusted healthcare profession for medical advice is physicians. And so we still have an important podium, an important platform. If we say we're not going to accept the old truths and to step forward. So that little pilot that your non-concierge prepaid semi-cash system is running around, that's a heck of a pilot. You know, that's so if that works, and then she sits down at her book club and tells two other doctors about this because they're going to do the book club on my book, right?
Yeah, right.
and they say, really, that works? All of a sudden, the early adopters are creating something that other people say, I hadn't thought that would ever work. Let me think about that. As opposed to a corporate fiat or a memo from above. That's right. real true change comes from people with high values and high intensity of ethics and leadership trying new things that other people go, wow, that's pretty cool. Yeah. I do a talk on leading positions through change, and I learned that so vividly. Credibility as a leader, we mistakenly think that credibility comes from our ability to influence. Let's stand up in front of you and wax eloquent about ideas and thoughts and solutions, and you will go along with it. Well, don't forget, complexity is also about relationships, because there's nothing that's that linear or that easy. So the complexity solution is your credibility is partly based on your ability to influence, but it's also augmented by your willingness to show you can be influenced. And that's listening. And so listening is one of the hidden parts to really good leadership. It slows you down as you establish relationships, but it speeds you up as you develop them. So people say, we don't have time. We've got to do it my way. Let's get it done. That's true if the building's on fire or if you're in the middle of a full court press turnaround. But if you're going to develop a culture that creates an organization with vibrancy and innovation, you're going to have to go the other way, which is to say, I'm going to have to spend a little more time listening, and I have to do things a little bit differently from my own behavior. I always say to people, so what is, if you want to be a leader, what should you think of every day? And I said, don't forget, I'm a surgeon. I like to think of things that I can carry on a 3x5 card. I said, every day, if I'm going to be a leader, I have to think about how I'm going to do three things. Number one, manage myself.
Yes.
How am I going to show up? Because if I'm a leader, people look to me as to whether they want to believe me or follow me or be part of a team or a group that I'm part of. So manage yourself. Secondly, develop great leaders and teams. A relentless, continuous process of coaching, developing, investing in people, leaders and teams. Not just, well, you're miraculously now the chief of surgery. Good luck. And the third one is learn continuously. I was at a symposium in Dublin last week, and I gave three talks. I said, either I'm getting slower or something, because I've never learned so much in 2 days as I learned there. I said, my God, I was one of the speakers, and I spent so much time taking notes and questioning other speakers. And I said, but you know something? It was really, really fun. So part of our career as healers is we got to be continually reinventing ourselves. And, you know, people say, oh, Conklin, you're full of something. Yeah. You know, you stand up in front of a group and you're all ex-CEO and you're all smart and you know all this. Well, you know, nothing was handed to me either. And nothing was handed to a lot of us that morph and continue to try to learn different things. And, you know, if we opt out and just stay crabby on the sidelines, patients lost the voice.
Well, Dr. Conklin, we're going to have to cut it off there. I really appreciate the conversation. And I'm so encouraged through this podcast. I've only been doing it about a year now, but to talk to so many people and learn so many things about what's going on, like that direct primary care, I had no idea. And that's just in my own community. It's gone from one to now there are four of those practices, and people and physicians really enjoy it, and patients seem to like it. It's fun watching those experiments and watch people innovate and try and solve these super complex problems.
Well, what's so cool about that is that it started out as a concierge solution, right? It started out for the haves who could afford to bypass the system and pay directly. And now your doctor and others have said, wait a second, the principles can work much more broadly. And we can actually take advantage of this for all kinds of people. That is so cool. That is so cool.
No. I talked to a pediatrician who is doing it in New York, and he's actually, he has an office, but half of his visits are actually house calls. And he's, again, very affordable for his pricing because they are overhead is so low. So it's very interesting.
And e-connectivity, I mean, people say, well, are e-visits good or bad? Well, they are a component of the trusting relationship over time. That's all they are. And they don't replace trust. They don't replace the face-to-face when it's needed, but they can replace a lot of wasted visits to the doctor.
No question. Yeah. I think my friend said, who's this doc, she said, you know, most problems in primary care are not urgent. I can see you tomorrow, but just shoot me a text. So just patients shoot her texts and she'd tell them, oh, I'll see you tomorrow, or you need to go to the ER or whatever. So it's kind of, it's been really very interesting.
The beauty of texting and email is it's asynchronous. You know, you don't have to have an answer. I don't have to say, set up a phone call for 8:30 on Saturday morning and we'll talk. No, you know, I can get back to you, you know, just in time or tomorrow. It's it's taking the technology of the day with the understanding and the inspiration of the healer and saying, I'm going to work differently. I'm going to learn how to lead, and I'm going to learn how to partner. And I'm not just going to have to be the omniscient doctor with the office visit.
Yes, I think when we leverage technology to enhance a relationship, that's where we're most successful. Well, your book, Healer Leader Partner, is really good, and I would say the second half, and about half my listeners in my unofficial demographics are not physicians, and so they listen to this to find out what we're dealing with and sort of what things are challenges we face and how that affects them as patients and looking for solutions. And I'd say most of the book is really leadership, and it does not have to specifically focus on physicians. Most of the leadership qualities, most of the things dealing with difficult crowds. I mean, like I said, there's a lot of stuff in there that I wish I had known ahead of time before I had my role as a leader. And it's funny because when I talk to other patients now who are managers or at a restaurant or wherever, we can commiserate. We actually have the same sort of experiences, right? I mean, most of your job is not business solutions as much as it is HR and dealing with difficult employees or situations and sort of how to navigate those. So your book.
If you look at the acknowledgments in my book for the people who acknowledge it.
Oh yeah, they're not.
You will notice that many, many of them are not physicians.
They're not physicians.
CEOs, PhDs, MBAs. They are not physicians, and they have all said the same thing. This is a general leadership book. This is not just a book for physicians.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so your book will be on the show notes page at paradox.com/044. Is there anywhere else patients can try and track you down to find out what you're up to? Like on Twitter or I don't know where
are you? I have a website, www.jackcochranmd.com. I do public speaking, and I have we have got more things to cover, but we're out of time.
Yeah, I had all these questions that we got to like a quarter of them. Pick up the book. I really highly recommend it. And thank you so much. Thanks. And have a great day.
Yep. Thanks very much. Bye now.
Thanks for listening to The Paradox. If you like what the doc is doing, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. And share the show with your friends. Become a supporting listener to get access to special bonuses at patreon.com/theparadox. Show notes can be found at theparadox.com.